Welcome to ArchaeoEd, a podcast about ancient civilizations in the Americas. I'm your host, Dr. Ed Barnhart, and I've been an archaeologist all around the Americas for over 20 years now. In this podcast, I'm going to talk about ancient civilizations that I find interesting. Sometimes it'll be overviews, sometimes it'll be very in-depth information. Basically anything I feel like talking about, because this is my podcast and I'm just having fun with it. I hope you enjoy it too. So, without further ado, sit back, relax, and let's get started. Episode 4, Tulum. Tulum is really an archaeological gem. It's one of the only ancient port cities still standing in all of Mesoamerica. The Spanish arrived in boats, so logically, port cities were the first places they conquered. They were also the places that were firmly ripped out by the roots and replaced with European ones. But for some reason, Tulum was spared that fate. At the end of this episode, I'll explain my theories as to why. But first, as I usually do, I'll explain the 5 W's of Tulum. Who, what, when, where, and why. Tulum was built by the Maya on the east coast of the Yucatan Peninsula, just north of what's now the Sion Khan biosphere. Today, it's an incredibly popular tourist destination. Only Teotihuacan and Chichen Itza see more visitors per year. But unlike those two huge ancient cities, Tulum was a tiny place. Even counting the structures outside of its walls, its population couldn't have exceeded just a few thousand people at most. Its central precinct is surrounded by a tall, thick wall on three sides. The fourth side lines the coast. Within the walls are beautiful temples, opulent elite residences, and a wide beachhead where cargo ships could land. To the surprise of the first archaeologists there, Tulum isn't that old. Though ancient Maya civilization goes back thousands of years, none of Tulum's structures are older than about 800 CE. As with many archaeological sites, there was slight evidence of earlier occupations going all the way back into the BCE period, but construction didn't start until late. Its roughly 800 CE start date is significant and telling. That's when the famous collapse of classic Maya society was happening, mainly to the south. As the cities in the Petén were abandoned en masse, it triggered a lot of migration. We know that Chichen Itza was founded by Petén migrants, specifically the Itza people. Tulum, it would appear, was their initial gateway into interior Yucatan. Tulum's appearance came along with a big shift in ceramic types on the eastern coast. And I know, ceramics are boring. But they're also an excellent clue for seeing when a community went through a big change. There are other earlier cities on the coast where Tulum was built, namely Tanka and Xel-Há, were two of the largest. They both had one style of ceramics before Tulum and then abruptly switched to the types Tulum brought. Those new ceramic types were clearly types in Belize and Guatemala, identifying the interlopers at Tulum as migrants from those areas. They were likely following older coastal trade routes looking for new places to live. The fact that Tanka and Xel-Há accepted those new Petén ceramic types instead of forcing their ceramics on the newcomers tells us that the newly established Tulum managed to dominate regional trade. See how boring ceramics can tell us important clues about history? The story is still not entirely clear. But there's reason to believe that Tulum played a central role in the establishment of mighty Chichen Itza. Starting at about the mid-800 CE, Chichen Itza became the major city of the Yucatan Peninsula, almost a capital, if you will. But just to be clear, it wasn't a capital, because the Maya were never a unified empire. They were a collection of independent city-states in a complex arrangement of allies and enemies. Chichen Itza, for a time, managed to make most of the other Yucatec cities allies, or at least compliant. We know that the Itza people who controlled Chichen Itza were from the south, around Lake Piten Itza in Guatemala. Tikal was just north of the lake, and those migrating Itza may well have included the refugee ruling class from that abandoned city. Chichen Itza has a few really complex and intriguing mural scenes painted inside some of its temples, ones that look to document important battles in the city's history. Debate about exactly what those murals depict has been going on for decades. Some of them may well show Toltec people arriving to Chichen Itza, but the archaeology says that wouldn't have happened until about 1000 CE. There's one particular mural found within the Temple of the Warriors that shows a battle scene occurring at a coastal location. Definitely not Chichen Itza, because it's in the middle of the peninsula. So where is this coastal battle taking place? Some scholars say the west coast, and that it's evidence of an attack and later dominance from Toltec central Mexico. Others, myself included, believe it's an event that happened on the east coast, when the Itza first arrived near Tulum in the 800 CE. A few mural detail clues lean me in that direction. First, it matches what the Maya said at Spanish contact, that the Itza came from the east, not the south. The mural shows a narrative sequence. First traders in canoes, then warriors attacking a walled coastal city that's burning, then captives being led away by those same warriors. On the east coast, we have Xel-Há, one of the two big cities there before Tulum. Excavations there found a defensive wall, not unlike the one depicted in the mural. What's more, that Xel-Há wall was partially destroyed and burned around 800 CE. The evidence fits very nicely for that being the Itza Entrada point. Soon after, Tulum is built and things on the east coast settle down. For the next 400 years, Tulum, Tanca, and Xel-Há are all trade ports for commercial exchange between Yucatan and Petén. So, it would appear that Tulum was one of the winners in the shakeup that was the collapse of classic Maya civilization. Their inception and subsequent raison d'être was to become a link between the diminishing Petén and the rising Yucatan. Okay, this is a good enough moment as any for a commercial break. When I return, we'll talk about some of the random aspects of Tulum that I personally find interesting. Hey, this is Ed Barnhart shamelessly plugging myself again. This time it's about an iPhone app I made called Tulum Be Your Own Guide. It's an app designed to help you be your own guide through Tulum. Its route is a map of Tulum, in which you can click on any building to get a description. You can read that description or press audio to hear me narrate it. It's not a static route through the site. You can go anywhere you want. You can point your phone at any structure and hit the What's That button. You can also click on any building and say, take me there, for a directional arrow and a distance feature function. You can really be your own guide. And though admittedly not my intention, making the app's information as complete as possible, I accidentally wrote the most complete book on Tulum ever made. No other single source has as much information about Tulum. It's only 99 cents, and you can find it on the Apple App Store. Once again, it's called Tulum Be Your Own Guide, and the author is me, Edwin Barnhart. Whether you plan to visit Tulum or just want to learn more about it, it's an invaluable resource. Okay, I'm back. Actually, you know, I wasn't gone just a minute. I was gone like a whole day. But for some reason, I feel the need to say things like that to keep up this kind of podcast magic for Right or Wrong. So, okay, forgive me for that. In this section, I'm going to talk about some aspects of Tulum that intrigued me, but don't necessarily fit into a smooth narrative. And I'm also going to intentionally hold back some of them, like Tulum's murals, for section 3 of this episode. So first, let me set the scene and describe the physical layout of Tulum a little better. As I mentioned earlier, Tulum is on the coast and surrounded on its 3 land sides by a thick wall. But overall, Tulum is a tiny place. The entire enclosed area is only about 400 by 100 meters in size. Within the walls, it's surprisingly open. Instead of densely clustered buildings in a small area, it's very dispersed. Now, I've never done an exacting calculation, but just eyeballing the map, I'd say about 70% of Tulum is just empty space. Now, those empty spaces might have once held perishable structures, or maybe they were intentionally left open for market activities, but we know for sure that they didn't hold stone-built structures like the rest of the place. The most common form of building among Tulum's roughly 70 structures, some of which are little more than stone outlines in the dirt now, is elite residence. There's a corridor in the middle of Tulum running north-south along the site's entire length. That's basically Tulum's main street. There's not much left of that street today, but you can see where it was based on the arrangement of the buildings lining it. Those buildings are mostly elite residences, each with courtyards, elaborate entryways, and some with their own chultun. Chultunes are water cisterns, filled by rainwater. It was no doubt prestigious to have your own potable water supply right there in your own home. There was also a larger fresh water source within the city's walls, a small cenote. Structure 35 was built over that cenote with a stairway going down to the water. It's hard to tell if Structure 35 was a residence or a temple, but either way, it was a finely built and important building for the city. The entire site slopes up from the inlandmost wall to the cliffs that overlook the sea. At the high point of those cliffs is a smaller, walled central precinct. Temples line that inner walled precinct, and the main structure in the middle is a palace structure called El Castillo. Again, we're not sure what that building's function was, but likely it was the home of Tulum's ruler. El Castillo is the largest structure at the site. It's 3 stories tall, and its eastern side has a commanding view of the sea. There are lots of interesting aspects of that structure, but I'm going to discuss just one here, one in particular, and that's its navigation windows. The east wall of its uppermost chamber has 3 windows running through its almost 1 meter thickness. About 100 meters out in the water is a natural reef. It's quite close to the surface and prevents boats from safely making it to Tulum's beach. There's only 1 big gap in the reef where boats can safely pass through, but you've got to know where it is. That's where Castillo's windows come in. I've never seen it published, but colleagues of mine told me about an experiment they did with 3 candles in the windows at night. They said that if the candles were lit midway through the windows, all 3 could be seen from a boat only when it was lined up just right with the gap in the reef. Now, I haven't seen this with my own eyes, so I can't be for sure that it's true, but if it is, Tulum had a lighthouse of sorts. Another temple in the central precinct that interests me is Structure 9, also called the Temple of the initial series. The building is small and only has one doorway, honestly unremarkable from the outside. It was what was found inside that piques my interest. It's called the initial series because a stela with a Maya-long count date was found lying on its floor. But strangely, we're almost certain that it wasn't made in Tulum, but rather transported and enshrined there. The text and the image of a woman in a jade skirt is very eroded, but the date can still be read as 9-6-10-0-0 or 564 CE. Remember that Tulum only started around 800 CE, so this stela is a couple of 100 years earlier. Through a line of evidence that I won't detail here, archaeologists have determined that it's from Qoba, a classic period city over 40 kilometers away. Why did Tulum bring it here? Was it a trophy of some kind? Or was the royal lineage somehow linked to Qoba? We may never know, but based on what I know about Maya politics, I'll venture a guess. Many ancient Maya alliances were sealed by intermarriage, binding two royal lineages together in a way not dissimilar from what happened in medieval Europe. When the folks from Petén first arrived to establish Tulum, they likely sought to marry into the largest local lineage, which was almost certainly Qoba at that time. From then on, they could claim local heritage. After the fall of Qoba, that stela probably became their proof or pedigree to the local merchants and the touchpoint to their shared ancestors. One more aspect of Tulum's history that I'd like to discuss in this section is quite recent. Specifically, I'm talking about its history of investigation. Stevens and Catherwood visited Tulum in 1841 and made some wonderful drawings and paintings of the site. The pair had traveled all around the Maya world, so it's striking that they said that this was the most unknown region they ever visited. Stevens said of the Yucatan's eastern coast. Now here comes a slight character voice. Ready for it?
In fact, I conceive it to be not impossible that within this secluded region may exist at this day, unknown to white men, a living aboriginal city, occupied by relics of the ancient race, who still worship in the temples of their fathers.
So that was Stevens. When the first archaeologist arrived at Tulum in 1918, a man named Samuel Lothrop of the Carnegie Institution, he had much the same assessment of the region. The situation at the time of Lothrop's project was kind of interesting. There were still no roads in or out of the region, only footpaths. The local Maya people had fought Spanish control for decades in a series of battles collectively called the Caste Wars. Just before the opening of the Mexican Revolution in 1910, President Porfirio Diaz proclaimed the region part of the state of Yucatan, but then left the rebellious Maya there alone. It wasn't until 1976 that the state of Quintana Roo was established. During Lothrop's project, the Maya still considered it to be the independent nation of Chan Santa Cruz. Lothrop got in and out of Tulum via boat from Cozumel, and the mainland Maya leaders forbid him from exploring or even traveling beyond the ruins. The workers he employed were given by permission of the local Maya leaders, who he never met. In his reports to Carnegie, Lothrop repeated Stevens' assessment that it was entirely possible that an ancient Maya city was still thriving somewhere in the nearby jungle. Even in the 1960s, the area was still very much under the control of local Maya people. I had the pleasure of being friends with one of the greats of Maya archaeology, Dr. Michael Coe of Yale, and once at a dinner party, he told me of his earliest experience at Tulum. Sometime in the 1960s, I forget if he told me the exact year, he traveled from Cozumel to Tulum,
There he met a small group of Maya men who identified themselves as Krushob, meaning soldiers of the Talking Cross. The Talking Cross was a supernatural being who led the Maya to many victories in the caste wars, and even today there are multiple shrines where the Maya still pay it homage. Tulum is one of those Talking Cross shrines, and the Krushob told Ko all about it as they together camped out for the night inside El Castillo. It kind of blows my mind that just 50 years ago, Tulum was that, and now it's Mexico's third most popular tourist attraction. And honestly, it makes me feel bad for the local Maya people who now find little more than low-wage employment there. Well, I guess this is as good a place as any to take another break. When I return, I'll tell you why I think Tulum ended its days as an Aztec military outpost. The ancient Maya calendar. I'm fascinated by it, and though I've been studying it for decades, I still learn new things about it all the time. I call it ancient, but I and literally millions of modern Maya people are still tracking it into modern time. Towards that end, I've created two products to help people better understand it: my annual Maya wall calendar and an iPhone app called simply Maya Calendar. Through these tools, you can figure out today's date, or tomorrow's, or a Maya date thousands of years in the past. The app will even calculate your Maya birthday and tell you about your personality traits and destiny according to modern Maya daykeeper priests. The Maya Calendar app is available through iTunes, but both it and my annual Maya wall calendar are available through my website, mayan-calendar.com. That's Mayan with an N, -calendar.com. Check it out. Okay, I'm back for part three. I told you at the break that I would tell you why I think Tulum was actually an Aztec military outpost at Spanish conquest. So, here we go. And let me say from the outset that this is a theory, not a fact, and that it's possible that I'm just crazy and flat out wrong. But I don't think so. I'm going to lay it out for your consideration. For hundreds of years after its establishment, Tulum remained much unchanged. When Chichen Itza fell and was replaced by Mayapan as the primary city of the Yucatan about 1200 CE, Tulum hardly skipped a beat. If not for another shift in ceramic types, archaeologists would have to conclude that the major peninsular political upheaval had no effect on Tulum whatsoever. But those ceramics were the same types found surging at Mayapan in the 13th and 14th century, so we know Tulum was still a functioning port of commerce for Yucatan. Tulum's major changes, and by far its most active building period, began abruptly about 1400 CE, the start of what archaeologists call the Classic Maya period. Again, ceramics changed, this time to a new type referred to as Tulum Red. But this time, architectural forms changed too. Many temples got flat roofs and outward sloping walls. Tiny temples, too small for human use, were built near the shoreline. The exterior of the central buildings displayed masks on their corners and diving gods above their doorways. The most dramatic change took place inside the temples. Murals that once had a distinctly Maya style were painted over in styles closely related to a style called Puebla Mixteca, coming out of central Mexico, over 1,000 kilometers away. The art was the finest Tulum had ever seen, but it was clearly foreign to the area. What caused those radical changes at Tulum around 1400 CE? Well, three major influences pull at a port city like Tulum: those who bring goods to their shores, those who lay claim to them once they land, and those who seek to export their goods from it. From the land side, Mayapan was the major power in Yucatan at the time,
still 50 years away from their civil war and fiery destruction in 1450 CE. From a wider Mesoamerican perspective, the major change was the rise of the Aztecs in central Mexico. Their capital city of Tenochtitlan had been established in 1325, and their sphere of influence was steadily growing. That growth, Mayapan's impending crisis, and Tulum's changes were all likely interrelated. The city of Mayapan was established with very noble intentions. 400 years of domination by Chichen Itza made it apparent that the Itza Maya, with their central Mexican political ties, were overlords of Yucatan, not the stewards they professed to be. So the Yucatec Maya, led by the powerful Cocom family, rose up and forced the Itza to return south to their homeland around Lake Pitanitza. The year was 1225 CE in the Christian calendar, but much more importantly, it was the start of the 10th Bachtun in the Maya calendar. A Bachtun is roughly a 400-year period, sort of the Maya equivalent of a century. The Maya, then and now, see the end of big cycles as times of renewal and transformation. For the Yucatec Maya of the 13th century, Mayapan was that transformation. The Cocom family led the construction of Mayapan and the creation of its new form of government, the League of Mayapan. Instead of a council of mostly foreigners like Chichen Itza had become, the League of Mayapan was made up of noble families from across the peninsula, each with their own council house in the city center. Together, they made wise decisions about the realm and promoted peaceful relations. Envoys of the League's members led frequent missions to ensure that the poor were fed and the sick were cared for. Within just a few decades of its inception, Mayapan became the most densely populated city ever built by the Maya. Sometime during the early days of Mayapan, a new group of Maya people moved into the Yucatan from the south. They were called the Tutulshu. The League treated them fairly and eventually gave them membership and their own council house in the city through which to join their representational system of government. But then merchants from the far west came calling. The Cocom family, still leaders of the League, welcomed those strangers too, especially the new commerce opportunities they brought to the peninsula. As those merchants, called simply Mexicans in the old chronicles, increased in number, so did their influence over the Cocom. More and more Mexicans showed up, taking permanent residence in Mayapan and wielding weapons said to be purely for the protection of their trade routes. Some of the murals in the city's public architecture changed at that same time to the more Puebla Mixteca style in late period Tulum. The common people of Mayapan became fearful of the well-armed, growingly militaristic Mexican traders, but they felt powerless against them. Finally, the Cocoms let them introduce slaves into the local market and ship them out to the west. The Tutulshu decided that enough was enough. They surprise attacked the Cocom family, slaughtering all but one who was on a trading mission into modern-day Honduras. The Mexicans were kicked out of Mayapan, but the vicious fight left the population heavily divided and the city in chaos. Without central leadership, pestilence and disease set in. The city was abandoned in 1461. The chronicles from Spanish contact didn't put two and two together, but we can. The Mexicans were Pochteca, the warrior merchants deployed from the Aztec Empire. In 1428, the Aztecs formed the Triple Alliance with Texcoco and Tlacopan under Emperor Ixcoatl, and then they began expanding the reach of their empire. The merchants at Mayapan were said to be coming from a large trading post called Xicalango. History knows Xicalango well because it was the place where Cortes received his first reliable intel about the Aztecs. Though its exact location is no longer known, it was a major trade port located in the Laguna de Terminos area. That's in the modern-day state of Campeche. The name Terminos came from the fact that multiple river systems drain into that lagoon, the Usumacinta and the Grijalva being two of those largest rivers. It was an ideal place for the Pochteca to launch into the interior and trade with the rainforest-dwelling Maya. The king of Xicalango was paying heavy tribute to the Aztec Empire and gave Cortez his translator La Malinche, a bilingual girl who was sold as a slave in the Xicalango market. Control of trade ports and terrestrial resource centers was the Aztec modus operandi. The Pochteca would run reconnaissance and establish the first trading footholds in a region. Then the army would move in to protect the empire's interests. Finally, the tribute or death decree would be issued. Sometimes a local lord would be brought back to Tenochtitlan to meet the emperor and to see the glory of the empire, and importantly, to witness a mass captive sacrifice event. That was just to drive home the point of how important tribute was to their new survival. Emperor Huitzotl used it to take over the Soconusco, modern-day Pacific Coast Chiapas in Guatemala, in the 1490s. By the time Montezuma II, the emperor who Cortez would kidnap, came to power, the Aztecs were taking over the Maya highlands of Guatemala. The names of the big cities there today, many ending in Tenango or Atlan, are in Aztec language Nahuatl, not Maya. Quetzaltenango, for example, was originally Xelahu. In fact, the modern Maya still call it Xela. The Quiche Maya capital of Cajamarca was renamed Utatlan, and its king, Lord Sevenno, was forced to marry two of Montezuma's daughters, effectively making him the emperor's son-in-law. When the Spanish went about conquering the Guatemalan highlands, they simply followed the Aztec trade routes down to its major population centers. Given this information, we can and should see Tulum in a very different light. When their architectural and mural style radically changed around 1400 CE, Mayapan was the dominant force in the Yucatan. Chronicles say that Mayapan gave the Mexican traders more and more influence over their market economy, and that almost certainly included a vassal city like Tulum as well. When Mayapan was abandoned in 1461, they left a power vacuum, one that the Aztecs no doubt exploited. After all, that was how they rolled. Sometime just around then, Tulum erected a strange new building with a circular platform on top. Aside from the astronomical observatories at Chichen Itza and Mayapan, the post-classic Maya did not build circular temples, but the Aztecs did. A circular temple was specifically to the wind god Ecatl, a deity of vital importance to the weather-dependent Pochteca sailors arriving to Tulum's beach. That new temple was placed prominently on a cliff above a shoreline, easily seen by vessels approaching from the north. But wait, if Tulum was actually an Aztec trading or military outpost, why didn't the Spanish notice it? The answer can be found in the chronology of the Spanish conquest. The first commissioned Spanish exploration of Mexico was launched from Cuba and led by Captain Juan Grijalva. He arrived to the island of Cozumel in 1518. Being naturally more defensible than the mainland, he set up the first Spanish outpost there and sailed the coastline. He noted three large towns on the coast in the Tulum area, but he didn't land. Following the coast around the peninsula, he got as far as Veracruz and noted particularly great wealth in that region. When Cortez arrived at Grijalva's Cozumel base the following year, he learned of Grijalva's assessment and made a beeline for Veracruz. The Maya were temporarily spared. By the time the Spanish got around to the conquest of Yucatan's eastern coast, the year was 1530, and the Aztecs had been fully defeated 9 years prior. Any outer garrisons like Tulum had been left without the support of the empire and abandoned. The Aztecs were generally despised by the people they subjugated and repelled whenever possible. The Spanish who landed in the Yucatan were looking for people and commodities to exploit, not abandoned towns. Hence, even if Tulum had been one of those big cities that Grijalva had seen, it had since become just another abandoned Aztec military outpost. And that, ladies and gentlemen, would neatly explain that while the Spanish found many Maya towns in that area, Tulum was not one of them. You've been listening to ArchaeoEd, a podcast written, produced, and distributed by me, Ed Barnhart. If you liked what you heard, then subscribe, like, share, comment, and do all those other things that I'm supposed to ask you to do. If you didn't, then don't do any of that stuff. And if you really liked it, support ArchaeoEd through my Patreon account. I make these podcasts for free, but I am not opposed to financial support. Until next time, thanks for listening. All rights reserved, copyright 2020.